Hey, I'm Liam, and this is Rob. Welcome to the Hey You Guys podcast. With all the hullabaloo surrounding Zack Snyder's Justice League this week, it seemed absolutely fitting that we go back and take a look at Tim Burton's 89 classic Batman, the apparently, and unknowingly, I'm sure at the time, the start of the DCEU, which seems a strange thing to say now, but I guess with Michael Keaton due to reprise his role as Batman in the Flashpoint movie, I mean, this is all part and parcel now, right?
Yeah, well, they've got to be tying it all in. So it makes you wonder, though, is that if they're bringing it all in from different universes, is every Batman going to be canon?
I don't know, man. You can't have, I mean, beyond the fact that he's dead, I don't think you can have like the Adam West one. You definitely, nobody wants George Clooney coming back. That's for damn sure.
So, I don't know. There's always a place for the Bat Nipple universe, I think.
Well, it could be its own universe. Honestly, I rewatched Batman again today for the podcast, obviously, yeah. And right after it, Batman and Robin was on Sky, and I watched the last 20 minutes. I don't think anyone needs a universe of that. I can't even watch it in like a so bad it's good. It goes beyond so bad it's good. It's like you get some films which are really bad and you're like, oh, it doesn't quite get to so bad it's good. This gets to so bad it's good and then just keeps fucking driving down the street and gets to just truly horrendous.
It's awful, mate. Like I said, this is for Batman 89, but Batman and Robin, it's...
Yeah, we're definitely doing... We're not... Just to be clear, we're definitely not doing a podcast on Batman and Robin.
Oh, no, God, no. But you know, I actually ended up watching that again, and Annie's one-liners, or Annie, can't even save that film. It's...
No.
It's awful. It's
really
bad. Is nothing justifiable from that film. There's nothing salvageable.
Nothing salvageable. Too many syllables at this time of night on a Sunday.
There's nothing salvageable from that. It's just...
The only thing I'll give it, and it's the same way if you go back and watch like the 70s, early 80s era's James Bond film, which I'm not the biggest fan of, especially like the Roger Moore stuff.
Yeah.
But the one thing that stands out from those films, and I know some people are fans of those, whatever, but the set design is amazing. And that is one of the things I'll say about the Schumacher film, even if it's not, it's not my cup of tea or the neon and stuff, but some of the set design is unbelievable. You just like, you see it and you're like, most of that's not CG. I mean, the stage that they must have put that must have been absolutely epic. You can see the money all over it. It's just a shame that the movie's an absolute turd. But we're not going to get caught up in Batman and Robin. The point is, we're talking about
Let's Batman go Batman 89, 89 then. And do you know what I got to say about Batman 89 is?
What's that?
At least it looks good.
At least it looks... What, so you're not a fan?
Oh, my God. I struggled.
Just to be clear, for listeners, because obviously we don't record this, he is looking at me through a Zoom call now with the 89 Batmobile and Batwing on his wall, both of them. Huge. Like absolutely dominating the room. And this is a dude who doesn't enjoy the film. It's insane.
I'm a Lego architecture fan. Well, not
architecture. Okay, fair enough.
I'm a Lego fan. But I'm going to say, at least it looked good. The Batmobile and the Batwing, fantastic machines.
They're
and
the
I
best.
Will actually, I will turn around and say that it's the best Batmobile on screen.
Oh, 100%.
The Tumbler, which is up there as well, is more of a tank.
We'll get to the lists in a bit, because I have so many lists, but 100%.
There's me justifying why I have these above my head.
fair enough.
But, I don't know. There was a lot to pack it. Like, Jack Nicholson loved doing what he was doing. He chewed up the scenery. He loved it.
100%.
I don't know. They didn't... It looked great. Like, Gotham City looked great, the one street they were always outside in. But they couldn't actually determine whether it was the 30s or the 80s.
That's the charm.
And
that's the charm.
It looked good. It felt out of place. I don't know.
And just be clear, I mean, some of this could be obviously linked to nostalgia, which is a big, obviously, theme of this podcast. But I mean, because this is my Batman, like the 89 Batman. I remember when it came out, I remember it being a massive deal. But I love the look of this film, and I love the fact that it's completely timeless. The fact that it's got that kind of retro futuristic style. You don't know if you're in the 50s or if you're in 2030 kind of thing. And I love the fact that everybody's wearing like the hats and stuff. I just, the Gothic architecture, the fact is, when I say this, I don't mean Metropolis isn't Superman, but the Gotham, when I see it, what comes to mind is Fritz Lang's Metropolis from the 30s. I'm not sure if you've ever seen that film.
No.
But if you have a look at Metropolis online, Fritz Lang, you'll know the robot. It's what C-3PO is loosely based on. And you'll know the architecture. It's very Art Deco. And he's taken that look, well, I assume he has, because that's what it looks like to me, and added that sense of gothic kind of dread. And I think the whole thing is just soaked in mood. And it's one of the things Tim Burton, and this is, you know, this is peak Tim Burton. This is before Tim Burton, yeah, you know, went off the rails a bit. But I think he brings so much to this with the aesthetic. And I think the film itself, I like, you know, the narrative's fine and stuff like that. I actually think it's one of the best Batman films. But so much of it is the characterization, the performances, and to speak to your point, in my opinion at least, is the imagery. You know, and that comes down to not just the style, but I think, you know, the Batmobile might be my favorite Batmobile. The Batwing's amazing. Mm-hmm. I love the suit. You know, I love pretty much everything about this film from an aesthetic standpoint. So, right, yeah, completely disagreeing, basically. But
let's be clear. I grew up arguing Batman's case as well. As a comic fan, there's everything. Again, this was my Batman. But rewatching it seems to have lost something for me. Like, and you're going to get that as we carry on with this podcast, as we carry on with these films, you're going to lose some luster. And I appreciate, as you go on, people are going to say, okay, you've probably lost it now because of Chris Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. Don't get me started on the Dark Knight trilogy because we'll be here for hours. But I don't know what it is, right? For me, there is no good Batman.
Oh, see, but
you've got great Bruce Waynes. You've got people who play great Bruce Waynes. Michael Keaton is the best Batman.
See, I've got
this film still feels off to me. This film still feels off.
See, for me, this film, just like it originally did, it got me early doors. And what I think, it was a theory I had actually, it was that the more pressure a movie's under in terms of casting, the more they have to prove themselves, the better the introduction usually is. Like the introduction to Batman in this, even though it, you know, thematically and, you know, the structure isn't the same, what it reminded me of was Daniel Craig in Casino Royale. Because before Casino Royale came out, I'm sure you remember, everybody was like, listen, Daniel Craig's not James Bond. Nobody was convinced. Like the blonde hair was a massive deal. You know, the idea that he wasn't handsome enough. And what that led to was, to my mind, the greatest James Bond intro of all time. The monochrome fight scene in the bathroom, which led into the parkour chase.
Yeah.
And I was I remember watching it. And I think it was the same for everyone in the cinema. You're like 10 minutes into the film, and by the time he turns around, he kills the guy in the bathroom, turns around, shoots at the screen in classic Bond style, you're like, fuck, that's James Bond. Like, you're just like, all that conversation, all that bluster beforehand, it's all forgotten in a 10-minute spell. And it was the same with this. Like, obviously, the internet wasn't a thing in 89, but there were 50,000 letters sent to Warner Brothers. Letters, you know, that's an effort. This isn't a tweet. People are posting this shit to Warner Brothers saying, listen, we don't want Michael Keaton as Batman. And like, I look back and I get it because everyone, you know, this is the Frank Miller era of Batman, you know, when it was like dark and gritty and everyone's like, oh, we can't have another Frank Adam West Batman, a big camp mess. And they're fucking hiring a comedian.
Yeah, because so, primarily he was a comedic actor before he did this.
Yeah, yeah, and he just done Beetlejuice before this. I mean, I love Beetlejuice, but I get it why you think, you know, and let's be honest, physically he doesn't look the part. And you're like, man, you know, I think I would have been in the same boat back in 89. As much as I love Beetlejuice, as much as I love Michael Keaton, I probably would have been like, man, this guy is Batman. And for me, within 10 minutes, the moment he grabs the guy, you know, they have that speech on top of the, you know, they've robbed them in the alleyway.
Yeah.
And they're like, ah, they ain't no bet and all that jazz. And when he comes down, he grabs him. He's like, what are you, man? And he does the, I'm Batman. Like that was the intro. That was like, he's created the template. Not just that film, but for Batman going forward.
In Michael Keaton actually added that I'm Batman because in the script, it was I am the knight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was. Yeah. And he changed it. He was like, it's much more simple. And you just think, I just remember thinking, it's like, he does that. And in one line, I'm like, yeah, you fucking are Batman. You are totally Batman, dude.
But again, I'm agreeing with you that he definitely is. Because before that, you had Adam West. And, you know, you're going to get the... And like you said, I think it was Batman, The Dark Knight Returns was in the 80s. So you 86. Had Frank Miller's, yeah.
So you had Frank Miller's. Yeah, so it's like two years before they started kind of filming, I suppose.
So you wanted that Batman. Like I said, people were seeing a comedic actor come into it. And I think for on screen, he is the perfect Batman. But I think what fails this now is time for me. Time beats nostalgia for this one. Like, it just doesn't feel like the gadget. Where he flies in, he's just coming down on that rope. You know, I just feel like none, and I'm going to say none of it feels realistic. It's a fucking Batman film. Do you know what I mean? But it just doesn't feel, it doesn't feel right on screen anymore for me. It just, for me, this is one of the cases where time beats nostalgia. The filming of it and everything, like, the way he floats in, I know that was fantastic back in the day, but yeah. It's one of those things where you can see the wire. I know you're meant to be able to see the wire, but you can
He does use a wire, in fairness, but I know you
now understand how the sausage is made. So it didn't feel right. But what I will say, and I will keep making excuses because I really wanted to love this again. They all loved what they were doing. Jack Nicholson, for a fact. Chewed, like I said already, he chewed the scenery, but he loved.
He's great in this as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things
great in this
I was going to ask is that, because in the start, he's obviously unhinged, when he's Jack Napier.
Yeah.
And we'll obviously have a talk about how they kind of rejig the Batman origin story for this. But, you know, he's obviously a bit of a psycho, but, you know, he's just like a gang guy. You know, he's pretty high up, but he's under Jack Palance's, what's Jack Palance's character name? Grissom.
And he looked like Skeletor.
He did look a bit like Skeletor, yeah. But I do like Jack Palance in this as Grissom. And he's obviously shagging his wife or his girlfriend, whatever. But do you think it's because of his appearance? You know, after he falls into the vat of acid.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously it changes his appearance. He goes off the rails then. And this is, let's be honest, like, obviously it's got a slightly comedic edge. But this might be the craziest Joker on screen. I really think it is. Like, he's a lunatic in this. And I'm like, I think maybe that moment in the film, you know, the mirror scene, the mirror, and, you know, he has a look at himself and he just starts laughing, loses his shit. And then from that point on, he's just like, I'm fucking doing what I want. And, you know, what he does to, what's her name? His girlfriend?
Oh, yeah. I watched it today as well. Why do I not?
Oh, what the hell's the name? I wrote it down somewhere.
Alicia.
Alicia, I had Alice in my head.
Yeah.
But that stuff he does to Alicia is so messed up. Like, he scars her face first, and then he's like, oh, that's not enough. So he throws her out of a window. Like, what the fuck?
It's the conversation he's having as well. When he's talking to Vicky Vale about her, and he's he's saying, she's my canvas.
That artistic chat.
And it was just,
I love all that stuff.
He just sees things to mold and
I think he's great in this, and I think he really goes for it, as you said. And I even to the point where I'm like, do they actually homage, I suppose, two of his scenes in The Dark Knight? Like, there's the scene, you know, obviously there's the famous pencil scene with Heath Ledger. Is that like a slight homage to the hand zapper thing? Because it's the same thing. He's got all the gang bosses around him, and he's just like, you know, somebody's talking shit about him. So he goes up, he shakes his hand, and obviously he fries him to death, or whatever the hell he does to him. And I was just like, that has a very similar vibe, and I wonder if it was like a direct homage to that. And the same with the ending. The ending of Dark Knight is actually really similar to the end of 89 Batman, with, you know, Joker falling off the top of the building and stuff like that. Like, you know, that can't be a coincidence.
No. That scene with all the mob villains, why did they all look like Dick Tracy villains?
They totally do. But again, it fits in this world. But
the guy at the beginning who sat next to Joker looked like Albert Einstein.
Dude, nothing about this makes sense. It all has that, like you say, that 50s era, you know, kind of old-fashioned mob mentality, right down to his goon. Like, Bob the Goon is the worst sidekick of all time. I had a look. That dude was like my age when he did this film.
Yeah.
He looks about 72 years old. But bizarrely, for some odd reason, when I grew up, I had two Bob the Goon figures. I'm like, why the hell did I have two Bob the Goon figures? The same one, twice. I bought it once. I was like, man, I love this so much. I'm going to get another Bob the Goon figure.
Bob says one of my two favorite lines in this film.
What's that?
So I got two favorite lines from this film. It's fantastic. So Bob, when they... when they shoot Batman and he's dead and they go in, who is he? And Bob just turns around and goes, check his wallet. Like, they're looking at this guy lying on the floor.
And he's totally deadpan as well, isn't he?
Check his wallet. Check and his the wallet. Other one, when they're in, was it Axis Chemicals? Why they changed it from Ace Chemicals, I don't know.
I don't
but,
know.
When they're in Axis Chemicals and the Bullock guy, Harvey, but his name was Eckhart in the film, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I'll get to him in a minute.
Oh, but he's given, so he's given everyone a piece of paper and he's going, this is your guy. And he just deadpan again, just looks at him and goes, shoot to kill, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and it's just like, we know exactly what you mean. He's the worst cop in the world.
But you know, shoot to kill, if you know what I mean. Like, he's winking at them going, yeah, we're going to shoot them. Like,
you know who that is, don't you?
Go on.
Who that guy is. He's played by a guy called William Hookins, and he is possibly most famously Porkins from episode 4, A New Hope.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, he is, isn't he?
He's the fat X-Wing pilot who they had the audacity to call Porkins, which seems like a very unsubtle joke to me, but I had no idea until I looked it up today. I was like, that's fucking Porkins. Like, of course it's Porkins. But yeah, I love Eckhart. He's the worst cop in the world. But that line is gold. And funnily enough, one of my favorite lines isn't by Bob, but it's to Bob. And it's when Joker says, Bob, remember, you are my number one guy. And I'm like, and as I'm saying that, I'm fully aware that I'm doing an impression of the Joker doing an impression of Jack Palance. So it's a long line there. But for some reason, I just always love that scene. And you know that was ad-libbed.
Yeah,
by Jack Nicholson, 100%. But speaking of Bob, and obviously I had the toys and stuff. It's one of the things that I just wanted to stress, like going back to this film, was just how massive it was in 1989. Like, this was like a pop culture sensation of which I had never seen before. Because when I was growing up, obviously there was Star Wars, there was Indiana Jones, but those had come before. Like Star Wars, you know, the last Star Wars film at the time, Return of the Jedi, that was released the year I was born. We were still playing with Star Wars toys from, like, you know, the early 80s and stuff.
Yeah.
This was, like, the first thing I remember as being this, like, massive new thing. Because, as I said, like, if you looked at, my toys and stuff at the time, they would have been Transformers, He-Man, and Star Wars. And all those had been out for years. Whereas this was, like, this new thing. And I remember, like, the poster for this film is dope. Just the bat symbol. And it's so great. That black and yellow, just, I think, again, so much of this film, I think, is still the default when people think of Batman. And I think it's proved as much almost by the Lego movie. Like, if you watch the Lego movie, they use the Danny Elfman soundtrack. I think most people, when they think of the Batmobile, they'll think of the 89 Batmobile, the suit, the symbol, the music, you know, Gotham itself. I still think it's very much, you know, obviously, Christopher Nolan's Batman was huge, but it's not quintessential Batman in the same way, I don't think.
No.
I really think, on screen at least, this is the quintessential Batman. And a big part of that really is, as I said, the look and the soundtrack. Everything about it, even if you don't like the film, like, that audio-visual combination is just pure Batman.
Well, that's it. See, and this is where I'm probably going to get some hate, because I can't pinpoint exactly why this film doesn't sit right with me anymore. Because obviously, I loved Michael Keaton as Batman to a point. Love Jack Nicholson as the Joker. It all just, like, the writing, started to have some issues. It looked visually for 1989 up to it still looks good to a point. Like,
most of it does, yeah. Yeah,
it's still there are a certain thing. Like, the animation, when you first pan up and you got the silhouette of Batman and then he turns around, and that would. That would fit in the Batman the Animated Series, kind of, where he turns around. Like, you could tell that's animation. You could tell it's a bit shoddy now, but it still holds out. Even
it gets away with that, I think, a lot of it.
Even the Batwing flying in front of the moon and stuff, that visual is fantastic.
Yeah.
As it drops out. And you're saying about the toys, I do remember having the original Batwing toy with the little darts that flew out. Because I remember having air battles with that and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles blimp.
Oh, so you were doing early Doors crossovers. I reckon the Batwing's going to fuck up the Turtles blimp.
Oh yeah, you got to shoot. All you got to do is shoot the blimp, and it's done. Isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it does. It has a moment in the film where it's essentially Batwing versus blimps at the end of the film.
And so, when you're building your Batwing, mm-hmm. at what point do you turn around and go, "Do you know what I need in this? Pincers."
Pincers at the front.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to need some pincers in my Batwing.
That is one thing. Obviously, you know, in Justice League, you see kind of Bruce Wayne working on the cars with Alfred. Yeah. You know, and obviously they've got the whole Wayne Enterprise thing in the Nolan films. In this film, like, as much as I love the Batcave, it's all visual. Because in terms of practicality, it's fucking useless. I don't even know. How does the Batmobile, once it drives in and it's just surrounded by sheer cliffs, essentially, it's like, do you have to just reverse it out slowly the way it came? It looks very awkward.
It didn't even look like he was on a turntable like in later films.
No. Yeah. It just looked like it was concrete. And the whole thing, it lacks practicality. And at some point, I'm like, who's actually creating this car? Who's worked, like, you know, say he's looked at it, he goes, listen, all right, he's got balloons. We should add pincers to the Batwing. But yeah. I'm like, where's the Batwing being kept and who's working on it exactly? I just don't know how it's all there.
Also,
I don't, from a practical level, I just don't think it's working.
The guy who's creating his weapons needs to ask a question. Going, look, Batman, Bruce, whoever is asking me to make these weapons, I think you've got enough grappling weapons.
He's got like loads.
Every time he grappled.
Loads of grappling weapons.
Every time he grappled, it was a different, delivery device. Every time he shot two wires somewhere or one wire somewhere, it was a different delivery. Like, and they keep coming to the front of his belt. So has he just got them all in the back of his belt? Just like he's.
I think he probably does. Like, I mean, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt, but that actually makes me think, because, you know, you're just like, well, why don't you just carry a gun? And then someone will be like, well, Batman doesn't kill. And I was like, yeah, he fucking does. Like, everyone had an absolute boner when Ben Affleck started killing everybody in Batman versus Superman. And for one, that's kind of half justified by the fact that it's supposed to be a jaded 45-year-old Batman who's, you know, like his head's gone, you know, Robin's been killed. And it's like, the only way I'm going to do this is by killing folk. In this film, nobody talks about the fact that Batman totally kills people. I mean, at one point at the end of the film, he literally says to Joker, he's like, I'm going to kill you. And then he punches him off the top. Like, he's clearly trying to kill him. He punches him off the top of the building. And there's even the bit when the car, albeit via remote control, drives into, what's it called, Axis Chemicals. And all those, like, the shields come up, all the goons surround the car, and just either side just drops two bombs and blows the entire building. How many people died in that? Like, you know, even if no one else in that building, there's, like, four goons around the car. They're blown to smithereens.
Yeah.
Michael Keaton 100% kills as Batman.
Oh, yeah.
100% kills. And nobody seems to care about it.
Can we... Can we look at the suit as well?
Oh, I love the suit. Not practical, but I love it.
Oh, iconically, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it looks great. But yeah, if you want to take Batman out, just approach him from the side.
Yeah, even from above, because the thing is, I'm going to do this, people can't see it. He can't even look up without leaning his entire body back, which kind of has a cool silhouette to it. But yeah, again, the thing is, though, this was the same all the way through until The Dark Knight. Even Batman Begins, he couldn't turn his neck. They made a big deal of it. It was just like, dude, we've got to make a suit where he can turn his neck.
Yeah, because they said that the main thing that they wanted to do was to have Batman be able to actually...
look.
Yeah,
basically. Peripheral
vision kind of thing. Yeah, it's just...
But that's the thing with this film. Like, even his fighting style and stuff, it's all very visual. It's all very mood, you know. It is more of a comic book kind of thing. Like you said, like, I appreciate when he goes up on, the one of his many grappling hooks, that it all looks very staged. But I think that staginess works with that whole timelessness. And that's why, you know, and a big part of that is, as you say, the characters selling it. And for me, Michael Keaton, I think he is actually, just to be clear, I think he's the best Batman Bruce Wayne combo.
Yeah.
Now, because I actually think the best Bruce Wayne is Ben Affleck. I think the best Batman is Christian Bale.
Ah.
But I think the best overall Batman is Michael Keaton, because I think he's the second best Batman and I think he's the second best Bruce Wayne. So I think overall he's probably just about my favorite.
I flip reverse that.
Oh, he's not flipping verse on me.
Oh, too right.
Shit. Oh, mate,
it's
got,
like, Bruce Wayne, like the whole smugness, the spoiltness and everything, mm-hmm. is Christian Bale for me, because obviously that's the younger Bruce Wayne.
I do not like him as Bruce Wayne. He's too boring.
I don't like him as Batman. Like, I like the Dark Knight films, mm-hmm. but I don't like him as Batman. Like, and I think a lot of it takes it out because I'm Batman and I'm going to talk like this. I can't get into it.
The thing is, after a while, it became more of a problem for me. But I remember Batman Begins and that first, you've seen it in the cinema. And when he pulls up the dude by his leg, he's like, I swear to me. Yeah. And I was like, in retrospect, it seems kind of funny. But I remember at the time, I was just like, holy shit. He's fucking terrifying. Yeah. And then when he grabbed him on the top of the car and he did the I'm Batman line again, I'm like, yeah, I'm fucking in on
it. He's yelling at them and everything, and that's fine. That's when the voice suits. But when he stopped and he's having a conversation like me and you are now, I'm talking to you normally.
It's a bit ridiculous.
If I start talking to you like this, we're going to have a car problem.
The thing is, Michael Keaton supposedly invented the Batman voice because he was the one who said...
He dropped his knock.
Listen... Yeah, what he just said, like, it makes sense that when I'm Batman, I should have a slightly different voice. If only, you know, one, to get into character, but two, because people would be like, dude, you're Bruce Wayne. Like, it's too obvious.
But his suit.
His Batman voice is bang on because it's rough. But when he's talking to Vicky Vale and stuff like that, like you say, it doesn't seem ridiculous. I actually don't mind the Ben Affleck Batman with, like, the slight voice modulation. I think it's quite good.
I thought that was good. And that's what...
Fuck, I think he just convinced me.
Controversial.
He is shit as Batman.
Ben Affleck as Batman is controversial, but I think...
I love Ben Affleck as Batman.
I do. But we'll cover that. Great. We'll cover that.
I love the physicality. I love the suit. But then, like I said, I think just about overall, Michael Keaton's my dude, and I cannot wait to see him in Flashpoint. It's like the elder statement. It's ostensibly the Nick Fury of the DCEU. I'm like, I am so on board for that.
I absolutely loved when he's in the car with Vicky Vale, or when he's in the Batcave with Vicky Vale, and she keeps trying to look at his face, and he keeps turning his entire body.
Yeah. Just like, if I did that in the car, I'd just drive the bastard into the wall. Son of a bitch. Yeah. And then it was one of the things when I learned to drive, I couldn't look out of the window because every time I look, my hands would go with it. And Batman's like, dude, you're going to drive us into the fucking river here. I'm like, oh, yeah. So
did you think you had the whole, like...
Yeah. I was literally driving like Batman, just like that. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Ridiculous.
But, oh, my God.
To come back to the film, I mean, one of the interesting things is that, like, the Marvel films... the Marvel films are a lot more hit and miss than a lot of other people. I can find them a touch repetitive and occasionally bland, albeit always incredibly well made.
Yeah.
But one thing they keep doing is, like, they insist on doing the origin story. And it was like Tim Burton knew in 1989, it's like, we don't need to do this again. Like, the start, you think it's going to be the classic, Martha and what's his dad's name?
Thomas, that's a fantastic bait and switch.
Think, oh, they're going to get murdered in Murder Alley or whatever the hell it's called. And it ends up being a crime alley. It might as well be called fucking Murder Alley.
Yeah.
And that's a great bait and switch. But again, it speaks to the fact that even in 1989, he's like, dude, we don't want to do the intro. Everyone knows what happened to Batman. And in fairness, the only reason they go into it at all is because the big twist in this film is that instead of it being Joe Flash, whatever his name is, the original
Chill.
Guy, Joe Chill. Joe Chill. Jesus Christ, I'm getting everything just wrong. They made, obviously, the Joker, Jack Napier, killed his parents. And there was a massive hullabaloo about that back in 89. And again, I see it as one of those things. I'm just like, it's artistic license. It totally makes sense for the film. It adds a connection between him and Joker because they don't actually have all that much screen time together.
There was a lot of that as well. Like, nobody could actually highlight who Bruce Wayne is, first of all, like, who's Bruce Wayne? And also, like, the death of his parents. Like, Bruce Wayne is Gotham's favourite son, as it were. Everyone knows that his parents are taken out in that alley.
Yeah.
But yet, in Tim Burton's film, no, it's just something that happened.
Well, there's a few strange things in this film, and that's one of them for sure. The other thing is the timeline on Batman, as in how far is he into his Batman career, so to speak? Mm. Because at the start of the film, The guys on the roof, the two robber guys, whether the, you know,
the one of them looked like the one that he holds over the thing looked like Tom Waits.
Yeah, it does look. It's Tom not Waits him, but I know what I mean. It does look a bit like him. But they're talking about him like he's a rumor. He's like, oh, you know, I heard about it. But they ain't no bet and all that. And then even Commissioner Gordon, when he sees him at Axis Candles, he's like, oh my God. Like, he's never seen him before. This is totally new to him. And it's the same, like, in the newsroom, everyone's like, there's no Batman. But then you cut to him and Alfred talking, especially when, you know, he's talking about him and Vicky Vale. He's like, oh, you know, if you don't settle down with her now, when will you? You know, he has this kind of world-weary sense, like he's been Batman for years. So it's like, is this his, like, you know, year one for Batman?
And if nobody's seen Batman, but they've seen that car driving around, like, do they think that's just some dude who's who's souped up his like Ford Focus or something? Just
Was that his first drive?
Yeah.
Was that his first time on the bat? Like, the thing is, I don't care because it's so cool. Like, and just to be clear, I totally get your criticism of this film. Structurally, it's a bit hit and miss, but and you could say it's maybe style over substance, but it's so stylish. Like, when the car shows up. And the whole the shields bit, I'm just like, dude, this is fucking cool as hell. Still,
it looks great. It does look
that
great.
Amazing.
And like I said, I love the Batmobile, the Batwing, everything. Like, I think all that's fantastic. I think it's great, and I do think that as a Batman on screen, it's still one of the best ones. But you put this film together, and it just doesn't feel. It feels dated, is probably the best.
The thing is, I mean, you said going into it, in fairness, before you rewatched it, we were talking about this briefly last week.
Yeah.
You don't have the same attachment to this film that I do.
No.
Which I totally get. And while I was watching it, as much as I love it, as much as I love the performances, even like the smaller characters, like we were saying about William Hookins as Eckhart and Jack Palance as Grissom. I love all these like minor roles. You know, even Robert Wool as Knox.
As Knox, yeah.
Yeah. I like him. I like Kim Basinger. She kind of like walks the line between damsel in distress and kind of, you know, woman on the scene, kind of, you know, and all that jazz. And even
speaking of her, she
got totally robbed.
Speaking of Vicky Vale, can anyone just show up and just get a job at this newspaper?
Apparently. Although she did have a pretty good CV with the photos and stuff.
But this is like she sat at his desk going, I like you talking about Batman. I want to take his picture. Like, okay, yeah.
Well, I guess he's got nothing else to work. No one else is believing him. And plus, it also helps. I don't want to be an asshole, but in that period, whatever that period was, I'm assuming it probably helped if you look like Kim Basinger. I mean, she's stunning in this film. Like the hair, oh my God, she just looks great. She actually came into the film like really late, didn't she?
Yeah, I believe so. She was one of the last cast, wasn't she?
Yeah, because she was supposed to be, I think it was Sean Young who was supposed to be Vicky Vale from Blade Runner. But she like broke a collarbone. And then Vicky Vale came in like last minute. But I guess we'll get to like casting what ifs and stuff down the line. The only, I guess, one is the Billy Dee Williams one, which is a story which is like quite sad because obviously they recast him for the Schumacher films, which might be a blessing in disguise considering how that went. It's, you know, obviously he's playing Harvey Dent in this film. And, you know, as we all know, he becomes Two-Face. And the plan was that Tim Burton would do the third film and he would become Two-Face. But he did get to play Two-Face in the end in the Lego movie, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Which was pretty fucking awesome. But yeah, I mean, I guess that kind of leads us into, unless there's anything else you wanted to cover. I mean, because again, I don't want to just kind of run through the movie. I think it works pretty well for the most part. I like a lot of the fight scenes towards the end. There's definitely a touch of like the Indiana Jones with some of the fight scenes where the dude just, like he's in the alleyway and for no reason, a dude just kind of flips over a wall.
I was going to previously just set up a trampoline over that because he gets some height on
100%. Oh, it's totally off.
And then you get the Indiana Jones like he just kicks him in the face and he's down. I know Indiana shot him, but that kind of thing. Yeah,
there's not actually all that many. Like the fight scenes are usually, and again, I guess it speaks to the limitations of the suit and stuff like that. But when he does have a fight scene, like the big one, I suppose, is right at the end before, you know, he has the showdown with Joker, and there's that big huge goon, for lack of a better word.
Yeah,
they have that fight. And it's a really well choreographed fight. You know, it's one of the things that Christopher Nolan didn't do very well. You know, as great as the Dark Knight trilogy is, the fight scenes are often a little, especially in the first one, Batman Begins, the fight scenes aren't that great. He's not fantastic at actually choreographing and filming fight scenes. And I thought, like, watching it again, I was like, oh, like, even in the suit, the way he moved, I was like, why didn't we get more of that from Batman? Yeah. And he's clearly not Michael Keaton, but I'm like, oh, I'm willing to let this fly. But sorry, before we jump onto Legacy, I've got to ask one more question. And this leads into the Batman doesn't kill thing. For the longest time, I was confused as shit about the scene in the Batwing when Joker is like, come on, you gruesome son of a bitch, come on. And he's just standing there. And he has all his lasers pointed at the Joker.
Yeah.
And he just fucking misses him.
Yeah.
And I was like, for years, I was like, wait a minute, is that because Batman doesn't kill? And at the last minute, he's at a moment, he's like, no, I can't kill this dude. And I checked up on it. It was like, no, Joker goes there. And he's like, I just want to face him down. And basically, the Joker's like, I'm ready to die. I just, because he's crazy and stuff. And Batman's trying to kill him, but he's just a terrible shot. And he gets shot down with his giant gun, which he pulls out of his pants. It's the weirdest fucking scene.
Because he had that gun in his pants, right?
Yeah.
Which obviously is going to stop you from bending your leg. But he's able to jump down from the thing. And I never noticed this in my previous watchings. He steps on a henchman's back like a stepping stone.
Yeah.
Gets on the floor. So he's bent his leg at this point to get down. He borrows Bob's gun to kill Bob. Poor Bob.
Poor Bob. He was terrible, but whatever. I will give him the benefit there, because even later on, when he's walking up the stairs to that ridiculously tall cathedral bell tower, whatever, he actually pushes the gun in, like it retracts. Yeah. So perhaps it's retracted in his pants.
As he's pulling it out.
It kind of, extends.
Well, he's just giving it a little tickle. He's just giving it a little tickle as he's pulling it out, just making it grow. Is that what you're saying?
And basically, that's exactly what I'm saying. And supposedly, and again, it said it in like the novelization of the film, that it had armor-piercing bullets in, and that's how he was able to take down the Batman.
One shot.
One shot. But as I said, for the longest time, I was like, was it because Batman just, at the last minute, couldn't kill him? I was like, no, it's just because he was incompetent.
Everything
terrible shot. Terrible shot.
Everything in that Batwing. He flips all these switches, you know, the... The Gatling guns come out, the rockets come out, and then he pulls out his... targeting system.
The little goggle things, they're the worst. They're the worst.
Look like a periscope.
On screen. Well, why didn't he use that for the Joker? Because he hits everything else.
Yeah.
And honestly, he must have unlocked, like, what? Like 400 rounds of bullets, 3 rockets, the whole spiel. Like, one dude who's just standing there, like, in the middle of the street saying, come on, shoot me. And he fucking misses. And that also leads to possibly the worst effect in the film. When I never noticed it was this bad before, but when it crashes, you can see that everything is just models.
It looks really cheap.
That one shot was like, it did take me out of it. Because I don't mind the matte paintings and stuff. I still think that looks quite good. But that bit with the models, I was just like, oh man, that looked a little bit amateur out of that bit. That was the only bit which took me out of the film, in fairness.
The ending.
The bit when Joker falls off the helicopter.
Yeah.
It just looks rubbish.
Yeah.
And you think this is a few years after the greatest fall scene in cinema history with Alan Rickman in Die Hard.
Yeah.
Unquestionably, like, to this day, the best fall scene ever. And you're like, why couldn't they make it look better?
And oh, so, God, I hope that's not a hostage. Still one of the best lines in the world.
Yeah.
But like the ending, the fight scene in the church, it's just, I love that fight scene, but as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, I've seen this before. And I realise this, again, flip reverse, because I have seen it before in a later film. But it feels...
This is going to become our catchphrase for the podcast.
Flip reverse.
Yeah, 100%.
The Crow.
Yeah.
Like that fight scene, again, and I know it's a bit darker in The Crow and everything, but it feels like they've taken what Batman did and they just made it a bit more brutal, if you know what I mean. But yeah, that touches on the whole Gothic style as well. I mean, the Gothic style of Batman, why wouldn't you end it in a church?
Yeah, well, that is the thing. It's like it's already got a Gothic aesthetic, and then they set the finale in the most Gothic looking building in the most Gothic looking city in the world.
Yeah.
And it is one of those things, like, even though it's Gothic, it's like the big thing at the time was everyone was like, oh, this film is so dark. And of course, you've got to remember, this is the time when the only real superhero film which came before that, like Marvel weren't on the scene at all in terms of movies. So it's just Superman, and Superman, you know, is the classic Boy Scout, especially in the Richard Donner 78 movie. And its subsequent sequels. So this really was quite dark, and obviously it was inspired to a certain extent by Frank Miller's graphic novel. But really, what it is inspired by is Tim Burton's aesthetic. Like, that's what shines through. I don't watch this film and think, oh, this reminds me of Frank Miller. It doesn't at all. It reminds me of Tim Burton. And the weird thing with the film is that the more it goes on, the more little Tim Burton-y quirks you get. It's almost as if, like, you know, they started seeing the dailies at Warner Brothers and they were like, oh no, we fucking, this guy's knocking out of the park. And all of a sudden you can start sneaking in these little like audio cues, these little before, like the cut, like what I always think, what I, my brother and I at least always refer to as the Beetlejuice scene.
Yeah.
The bit when Vicky Vale and Bruce Wayne are there and the Joker shows up and he does that, like, it's my favorite Bruce Wayne moment of the film when he does that little story to the Joker. He's like, oh, I tell you, this guy, Jack Napier, you know, screw loose and all that. And then he just like smashes the table. You want to get nuts? Come on, let's get nuts. And he just shoots him. It's just, oh, I fucking love that scene. I love that scene. But again, it's scenes like that in particular, which feel really Tim Burton-y to me when he's just being let off the leash, I think.
You play this film for somebody who hasn't seen it. Take the credits out of it. Just somebody will turn around and go, is this a Tim Burton film?
Yeah, totally.
Like straight away, you will feel that it is a Tim Burton film.
And yeah, like he's like maybe the most auteurish of all, other than maybe, there's like a handful of like classically auteur directors where you immediately, you're just like, I know this is one of his films and Tim Burton's one of them. And this looks like a Tim Burton film. Admittedly, not as much as the unbelievably Tim Burton Batman Returns, which he just, like, I watched that again recently.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't believe this got made. This isn't even a Batman film. This is a Tim Burton film back to front. This is a Tim Burton film where he's just thrown on kind of like a few Batman skins, so to speak.
Yeah, if you take the out there-ness of Batman and Tim Burton, and you times it by two, and then you add Tim Burton, times in him by 10, you get Batman Returns.
A lot of people prefer that to this film as well. I thought you might. I actually, and again, I wonder sometimes, is it the nostalgia thing? Is it because it had that massive impact in my life? I've always preferred this one. And I think a big part of that, admittedly, again, is the Jack Nicholson thing. But then when I watched Batman Returns, I'm like, man, Danny DeVito's so good as the Penguin.
Jack Nicholson is great as the Joker in this before, like, and he's having fun, and it's great. The thing about Batman Returns is that it's out there, and they know it's out there. It's nuts for nuts, and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Like, if I had to pick a Batman film between those two, I would pick Returns.
I get that, and, like, I like Returns. I prefer Batman just about. But the one thing, I mean, Tim Burton, like, was clear from the off, is that he's not actually all that interested in Batman.
No,
like these movies, this film could just as easily be called Joker. It's the Joker origin story, back to front. Like, he doesn't, like, the Batman backstory snuck in there for sure, but the emphasis is all on Jack Napier becoming the Joker.
Yeah.
Like, that's where his interest is, and him just going more and more off the rails. Well, like, the whole Smilex kind of plot thread, it kind of just about works. But I think, again, it's just for the aesthetic.
I love
Everything serves the aesthetic in this film.
I love how Joker gets doused in chemicals and he can become a chemist.
Well, one of the other things I've got to ask, right, is what the fuck happens to the Joker when he falls in the acid? Where does he go? Is it like a toilet system?
I don't know.
He just falls in and just disappears.
He ends up in the doctor's chair. And, like, was he smiling when he went in, or did they graft that smile onto him?
Yeah, like, obviously, I'm assuming it's affected his nerves. And then the doctors, you know, it's a botch job essentially. But then why does Smilex make everyone look like him? Like, I don't think it makes sense. No. I don't think it really needs to. It's just everything serving the aesthetic. It's fun. So yeah, mixed views on the film.
But the legacy, is it?
In terms of the legacy, obviously we've already mentioned the fact that its direct legacy is going to lead into the DCEU with him coming back. And, you know, as much as I'd love to think that they might bring back Tim Burton's vision of Gotham, I'm not sure if that's going to happen. I think it'll just be very much Michael Keaton. Sorry, my cat is walking all over my notes. Come on, buddy. You're making all the noise there. I think it will just be his Batman in the, what do you call it now? Do you call it the Snyderverse again? I don't know what the fuck it is
now. I think if it's Flashpoint as well, then they bring in all the Batman. Are they bringing him in as Thomas Wayne?
Going to bring him back. I think they're literally going to bring him in as the Batman from that universe, and he's just going to end up being, like I said, you know, I don't think we'll see him in the suit. I think he'll be an older Bruce Wayne, and he will just end up, again, for the sake of being lazy, he'll end up just being the Nick Fury of this universe.
Yeah, you know, as much as I
of felt the DCU love, multiverse thing.
As much as I felt your love for 1989 Batman, I do hope he gets the justice just for you now. Like, if they show him for like 30 seconds in this film, I can feel you crying.
Oh, no, no, no. There's no way you mention him. I think he's going to play a major role. And I think he would only come back for that. And I'm super excited because, like, again, one of the great things about Michael Keaton is that he doesn't look like a quintessential Batman. I mean, when you talk about, you know, Bruce, Ben Affleck, even Christian Bale to a certain extent, they look the part. Like, he doesn't look like your traditional Bruce Wayne at all. And I'm like, now in particular, like, you know, he's losing his hair and stuff like that. It's like, how are they going to sell him? Is he going to be like this really grizzled Bruce Wayne? Because it's not really his thing. He's like a wacky Bruce Wayne for sure, but he's quite a charming Bruce Wayne as well. So it'll be interesting to see. But obviously,
he's masked his darkness. Like, he's still got a bit of life left in him.
But in terms of, like you say, the legacy, I mean, obviously, it's never ending. Batman is going on forever. You know, we've just seen the Justice League and the return of Ben Affleck. And I tell you what, based off the reception to that, we might end up seeing a bit more of Ben Affleck Batman
for
sure.
If the studio looks at this properly, they might do.
Yeah, and with the multiverse, they can just keep going with all of it. I mean, you know, you would usually think that with Pattinson coming in for the Batman, for Matt Reeves' Batman, you think, oh, well, that's going to be the end of Ben Affleck, that's going to be the end of Michael Keaton. But instead, you're just like, they can all exist next to each other. Oh my God, my cat is, what are you doing? He's taking my earphones. Sorry, this isn't great podcasting, but my cat is going to kill either himself or me. Buddy, come on. All right, wait a second. I'm just going to put him on the floor. He'll be back, I have no doubts. But I mean, just to be clear, I'm super looking forward to Pattinson as the Batman. I love the trailer. I love the fact that Matt Reeves is directing it. I like the idea. But then I'm equally, like, I really want to see more Ben Affleck, and I want to see Michael Keaton return. So I am, like, all in on Batman at the moment. And I think the reason is obviously Marvel has become this absolute monster in the past 13, 14 years since Iron Man. But as big as Marvel is, when you're talking about a superhero character, I still think Batman is like leagues ahead in terms of the most recognizable, the most famous, the quintessential superhero, despite the fact that he's not really a superhero.
But that's why they're doing it. Like, they're doubling down on Batman. Like you said, you got Robert Pattinson now, and they're saying that his is a standalone story, so it's not going to be linked to any of the Snyder Cut stuff, Snyderverse stuff, or anything like that. And then you got like maybe some more Batfleck if that happens or whatever. Do you think that they're risking saturating it though? Like, DC has an epic list of characters that would do great with their own films as well. They don't seem to be worrying about, even in the Batverse. You could have a great Nightwing film. You could have Red Robin. You could have Damian Wayne.
Yeah, but I think first you've got to establish that main line. It's kind of like,
but they have, haven't they? Since 1989, they've established. You've had nothing but Batman films.
I'm just not sure if you can release a Nightwing film. I don't know, maybe you can, but when I think of Nightwing, I think of it as the same level as, say, something like a Black Widow movie. Yeah. But the thing is, with a Black Widow movie at the moment, and anything from there, it's the reason that Marvel now can afford to start doing interesting stuff like WandaVision, which doesn't really have any action until the end. It's actually, it's most boring when it returns to action, is the fact that it can be sold exclusively on that Marvel name. And DC isn't there yet. Like, it can be sold on Batman, it can to an extent be sold on Superman, but I still don't think it's established enough in the mainstream that you could just pull a Nightwing out of your ass or Red Hood or something like that. I think it's got to be established in the DCEU first, and then you make the movie.
I think it's because they're putting all their effort into Batman and Superman, and they need to expand.
No, I agree. And it's the big mistake that basically they're still trying to correct for now, is that they rushed it. The fact of the matter is, they made Man of Steel, which I thought was a great start. I love Man of Steel. I like the ultimate cut of Batman versus Superman. But at that point, before you get to Justice League, you've got to introduce the other characters, like they did with Marvel. They took their time. You know, it's easy to say, oh, well, Iron Man. Iron Man wasn't shit when that film came out. Nobody, the average person on the street hardly knew what an Iron Man was. But then the film was so good that it ended up establishing the MCU. Like, DC are arguably in a stronger position because they've got the two big cards in the superhero world with Superman and Batman. Mm. But then it's like, yeah, all right, off the back of that, you make a Cyborg film, you make a Flash film, then you do the fucking Justice League film, but they rushed it. And suddenly you're stuck with a film where you've got to introduce all these characters.
That's where I think they're going wrong. I think they're going wrong by trying to link all these films. Don't. Just do some standalone films. Just do some films with good storytelling, good acting, and see where it goes from there.
I think
they're saturating the market with two. And don't get me wrong, I will sit and watch every Batman film that happens.
Yeah,
it's
going to
happen. Me too.
I know what you mean. And there is a danger of it being saturated. But I mean, to be honest, I just like, as long as it doesn't feel, and it's the reason I like Man of Steel, it's the reason I like the Snyder Cut of the Justice League. While they're good films in themselves, one of the most important things about it is that it doesn't feel like a Marvel film. It, you know, and it's the reason the Joker did, I think Joker did so well. It's because it felt different, you know? And I think that's the important thing. It's like, I think you can do 4, 5, 6 Joker films, Batman films, as long as they feel sufficiently unique. And that's why I think the Batman with Robert Pattinson will be fine, because even, yeah, it's Batman again, but it feels a million miles away from Ben Affleck in the DCEU. So as long as you do, and that is one of the good things that I think DC are kind of leaning into at the moment. It's just like, we've got an element of continuity, but like the X-Men movies before, let's not get bogged down in that. Let's just do good films with good directors. And then just like, if it can tie together, it ties together, whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, like you said, the emphasis should always be on making a good movie first. You saw it, and it wasn't just DC. It was all of cinema. After they saw what Marvel did, and Marvel did it in a really careful, really constructed way, everybody was putting the cart before the horse. And they were like, oh, you know, every film, you know, it didn't have an ending. Everyone's like, oh, this is the start of an extended universe. Yeah. No, just make a good film first.
We won't even get into the universe of monsters.
Well, if you take Iron Man, for instance, yeah. If Iron Man had just ended and there hadn't been another Marvel film, it would have worked perfectly on its own. Yeah. Like that whole final line, I'm Iron Man, you'd be like, yeah, there could be sequels, but it would have worked as a standalone. But as I said.
Should we bring it back to 89 and...
Yeah. Sorry, we're getting a bit carried away.
Cover some facts for this one.
I mean, let's be clear. As part of the legacy, I was going to mention, like, it's easy, as we're saying now, like how popular Batman is. It's easy to forget that Schumacher fucked Batman for like a good 10 years.
Yeah.
Like between 97 and 2005, Batman was off the table because Batman and Robin was so bad, and even Batman Forever. So it's just, you know, as good as things are going now, it's, you know, it's easy to forget that one truly horrendous film can derail anything, you know? So, I shouldn't be ending on Batman and Robin, but yeah, facts. Let's go for it, dude.
Right, so we got a couple. One of the biggest ones was Robin Williams was offered the role of the Joker.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Which I think would have been interesting.
Yeah, because Jack Nicholson was hesitating, so they offered it to Robin Williams. Then Nicholson said he wanted to do it. So they just hung Williams off to dry and said, no, you're right, whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, if ever, you know, even I think for somebody of Robin Williams' stature, if they're like, oh, dude, we can't give you the part, and you're like, why? And they're like, well, we're giving it to Jack Nicholson. And this is 89, you're probably like, yeah, all right, fair enough. If you can get Jack Nicholson, dude, you get Jack Nicholson.
Williams wasn't happy.
Because
they hung him off to dry because they asked him to do the Riddler in Batman Forever, whether or not he saw the writing on the wall on that one or not, but... And he wouldn't work with the studio again until they actually apologized to him.
Can you imagine?
Just, telling the studio, I'm not going to work with you until you say sorry. Say sorry.
I think it'd be easy. Like, I get why he's upset. But personally, I'm sure I'd find it easier. Like, if they were like, oh, we're replacing you with some, like, fucking jackass. Like, that's one thing. But if they're replacing you with arguably the world's greatest ever movie star, or certainly one of the greatest, you're like, oh, okay, that takes the edge off slightly. But, yeah, so there was some... Sorry.
I was just saying... speaking of Nicholson again, wanted to keep him, they offered him a percentage of the film.
How and subsequent films and merchandise.
As of 2003, he earned $60 million.
Well, you think I'm... Supposedly now it's well in advance of 100 million.
It's got to be, haven't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you're getting a cut of every Batman film plus the merchandising, Jesus Christ. That's like Alec Guinness in Star Wars. Like he always says, it's like, you know, he wasn't the biggest fan of playing Obi-Wan Kenobi, but that paid for his family to live well for like generations because he got a cut of everything. Mm. Same with Keanu Reeves in The Matrix. Like if you get a cut and it ends up being one of those movies, oh my God, you're just getting paychecks forever. Yeah. For fucking ever.
Well, Marlon Wayans, who was going to be Robin in Batman Forever, it was Tim Burton's.
Yeah.
He still gets checks.
Marlon Wayans still getting paid for Batman.
Because they signed him to be Robin in Batman Forever.
Yeah.
Joel Schumacher chose not to use him. So he still got paid. So he still now gets checks.
That's amazing.
He still gets residual checks.
I laughed at that. It's like, I reckon Marlon Wayans would have been fine in that. I remember watching Batman Forever in the cinema in 95 when it came out. So I would have been 13. And I remember coming out and being like, I quite enjoyed it at the time. And I remember the soundtrack was a massive deal. But it was only later when I watched it again, I was like, dude, this film's not very good. It's too hammy. But Batman and Robin, I keep bringing it up, has a special place in my heart because it was the first movie that I remember being genuinely critical of, like a big film, like in that, you know, not just like, oh, I didn't like that, was that sense of disappointment because it was 97, I was 15. And I remember my dad, I went with my brother and my dad and we were really looking forward to it. And we all came out of the cinema and we just looked at each other and was just like, oh, that was bad, wasn't it? And we're like, yeah, it's just horrible, man. Horrible. But yeah, Schumacher just fucking tore it up. But it could have been a very different film, like you see with the casting.
Another Jack Nicholson one, my last Jack Nicholson one. Apparently, he loved his performance. He loved his own performance in this so much, he'd play it once a week in his house. So you imagine going to a Jack Nicholson party and he went, oh, fucking hell, Jack. Are we watching the Batman again?
I'd be all right with it.
I wonder if he had a supercut version of just his scenes.
But that is the thing. Like you said, he's got a lot to love because it's basically a Joker film. He's in it so much. Yeah, well, it's unbelievable. But
he's in there like, it's all the Joker, like the first quarter of that film.
Yeah. It's tons of Joker. It's more, well, there's a reason. Obviously, there's the paycheck, the fact that, you know, he was a bigger name than Michael Keaton at the time. But he gets top billing in this film.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a Batman film and Batman doesn't get top billing. The Joker does. So, yeah.
My last fact, unless you got any that I'm going to mention, was that we've made fun of Batman not being able to move his neck or anything like this. Mm-hmm. It turns out as well, he couldn't hear in this.
Oh my goodness.
When he had the cowl on, he couldn't hear anything.
And he had claustrophobia, so he was toiling.
So you had a claustrophobic, deaf Batman with a bad peripheral vision. Like, how was he beating anyone?
It's not great. Well, supposedly, Tim Burton said he loved that because it put Michael Keaton in such a bad mood that it made him broody, and he said it suited the character. But yeah, I mean, there was some interesting kind of casting for Batman as well. I mean, at one point they were talking about Kevin Costner. They were talking about Charlie Sheen. And one of them, in terms of that classic Batman animated series look, Dennis Quaid was in for the role. And Dennis Quaid, like, he couldn't look the part more. Certainly, you can imagine him with, like, the chin and, like, the Batman thing. I think he would have been an interesting choice. I'm a big Dennis Quaid fan anyway, but I know he's a bit of a character nowadays, but I certainly liked his late 80s output anyway. Yeah, but even at one point, they were talking about Willem Dafoe, and I'm like, Willem Dafoe? But the only thing is, like, when I say Willem Dafoe, I'm sure, say they had cast Dennis Quaid, if we were looking back at this now and we'd be like, dude, Michael Keaton almost got cast as Batman, we'd be like, what the fuck? Michael, no way, you'd be a terrible Batman. And he turned out to be the best Batman, so what the hell? What else do I have? Obviously, you mentioned the voice, blah, blah, blah. There's some interesting bits where he really kind of, I think they undersold it because there's a bit where Vicky Vale wakes up after they've slept together and he's hanging upside down.
Yeah.
Like he's sleeping upside down. And Michael Keaton wanted to make that a bigger part of the film, that animalistic style. And he said like when he became Batman, he wanted to go into a trance and turn into Batman. It's kind of like the Hulk almost. So they cut a lot of that, but they kept him hanging upside down, which on its own actually feels slightly out of place, I think. Yeah. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. But that was, again, with the voice and everything, it was all introduced by Michael Keaton.
I found one.
Oh,
sorry. I found one because you love him so much. Bob the Goon was cast by, the actor was Tracy Walter. Jack Nicholson convinced the filmmakers to cast him because they're close personal friends.
Obviously, yeah. Because he looked about 82 years old. He was, but mind you, saying that all the goons are rubbish. Yeah. And actually, one of the goons I did love, and this will take us into our next segment, which is the soundtrack. Which again, fuck, we could talk about this for ages. The goon who just carries around the ghetto blaster.
Yeah,
like basically, they're like, listen, what we're going to need, right? We've paid a lot of money for Prince to do the soundtrack. So we're just going to have one of the goons carry round a ghetto blaster and he can just play fucking Prince at any moment.
Immortalized in Lego form.
Oh, just to be clear, he's holding up the ghetto blaster goon from Batman in Lego form in front of me. I didn't know they turned him into Lego. That's awesome.
Part of the 89 Batwing, they gave him, you had the Joker with the quill, Batman. And Ghetto Blaster, man.
Awesome. Would that quill have killed in the way he threw it into his neck?
Like, I'm not sure. It's like Arnold Schwarzenegger firing his arrow again. It lost all trajectory. Like, yeah. That quill just, yeah. It just,
I feel like it would have bounced
off him and he would have been like, Jack, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, it would have been better if he'd thrown the quill. It just bounced off him and he'd look confused and then he'd just like, nodded to one of his goons, he just shot him in the head. Yeah. That probably would have been better. But yeah, basically, because they said, oh, well, he wanted the Danny Elfman score, which was obviously a great choice because... Yeah,
fantastic.
It's a fantastic score. Like, yeah. The intro, again, not just the intro, but the intro with, like, the bat symbol is amazing with the music. But I loved the last shot of the film with the music. Dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
Dun, 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 and it's going all the way up the building, just has him looking at the bat symbol. I was like... Even now, that kind of gives me chills. I love that scene. I love it. But the score all the way through is great. But the Warner Brothers wanted Prince involved because obviously he was shit hot in 89. And they actually convinced us, like, no, we can do both. We can have Danny Elfman do the score, but we can have the Prince soundtrack as part of the film. And they play two songs back to front in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
They have the amazing Party Man in the great arts... art collection scene, the museum scene, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. But the song Party Man.
The museum restaurant thing that I've never...
Yeah. Oh, but it's worth it. Just Party Man. Party Man. And what's the other one? Trust. I love Trust as well.
Yeah.
And basically, I'm pretty sure they just had the parade so they could just have them going through Gotham and they played the song again, start to finish. It was almost felt like a contractual obligation. You've got to have two songs. All the way through.
Because even though they're the two that stand out, one, two, three.
There's a few in there.
Six Prince songs in this film.
That's amazing. Yeah. But those are the two. They're the two.
They're the two standout,
100%. But yeah, between those, like, it's a weird mix to have that classic Danny Elfman score and then throwing in peak Prince. It's like, and let's be, again, like we've spoken so many times about it, this film has this really gothic aesthetic. Do you know what the least gothic thing in the world is? Prince.
Yeah.
Prince. And for some odd reason, it just fucking works. It's a bizarre combination. But
it's the right time. And again, it feels like a Tim Burton choice all over that. It just...
Yeah. And I love those intros as well. Like, we don't get them anymore. Like that, where you've got the music and you're not quite sure what you're looking at and then you suddenly realize the bat symbol. It was like the same with, like Alien... Like where it's got the moody music and like the letters keep coming in. Terminator, like da 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 da, and you kind of got this real close up on the letters and you don't quite know what it says. And it's like a Terminator. That seems to be a thing for a while, and it was really effective. But that's all going out the fucking window. But yeah. So to sum up, soundtrack and the score both fantastic.
That's something that holds up. The Batman theme holds up immensely.
And it's one of those things which DC have always knocked out the park. Like, Superman has two of the most iconic soundtracks ever. Like, obviously, the 78 original is the most iconic. Then you've got this. And then I would argue that Man of Steel has one of the best scores of any superhero film ever. I love the Man of Steel score. One of the things, as good as Marvel is, they don't do scores very well. And I know some people might disagree with me, but other than the Avengers theme, like, I couldn't hum a fucking Marvel theme. You know, since I've watched 89 Batman, I've been humming the fucking Danny Elfman score all day. I don't, like, finish watching Thor the Dark World, and I'm like, oh, man, I love that Thor theme. What the fuck's the... I don't know what the Thor theme is. I don't know what the Captain America theme is.
I love how you went to Thor the Dark World.
I know. I follow him. I don't know what the Iron Man fucking theme is. Is it AC/DC, maybe? I don't know. Like I said, other than Avengers, and bizarrely, I quite like the theme tune for WandaVision. Like, they don't seem to land. It's really strange. Whereas DC, like, they seem to nail it with the soundtracks. And as I said, when I think of Batman, I still think of Danny Elfman as being the quintessential Batman score. So great job anyway. But we said we're going to try and keep this one short. It's not happening at all.
I was actually going to say that before we move on to the next section, because we could do a whole podcast just on Batman games alone.
Oh, video games, man. This is a tricky one, because the thing is, I mean, they go back to 1986 on, like, the Amstrad and the Spectrum. But in terms of this film, they did come out in 1989. But for kids who weren't around there back in the late 80s, early 90s, the really interesting thing was that you would get a game based on the movie, but it would be, you would get, like, eight different games made by eight different developers.
Yeah,
like, there was there was, like, the Ocean Software Batman for the Commodore 64, for the Amiga 500. There was the NES one. There was the Genesis one, or Mega Drive. That was made by Sunsoft. The Game Boy and PC Engine ones, they were completely different. But they were all actually pretty good. The 89 Batman video games were actually pretty decent for the time. And I remember the Amiga 500 was in the UK was bundled with the Batman game. And I remember it being sold in W. Smith's. Back in, like, the early 90s, it was, like, a massive deal. It was like, oh, yeah, you buy the Amiga 500 with Batman. I was like, oh, dude, that looks amazing. But obviously, you know, since then, there's been hundreds of Batman games. Yeah. But until quite recently, the vast majority were shit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, a lot of them are really bad.
Yeah.
And it was only, you know, out of nowhere, Rocksteady obviously made...
The Arkham games, yeah.
Oh, dude, they're the best. Mm. That is the thing. Usually, part of this conversation for other films, like, oh, who would you have today make a video game based on that property? And the obvious answer is, well, Rocksteady, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because they make great games. Like, I loved Arkham Asylum. I loved it when it came out. And, you know, as much as I like City... that's actually, I know it's a lot of people's favorite. That was actually my least favorite. And I think Arkham Knight, the third one.
Yeah.
We won't talk. There was obviously Warner Brothers did Arkham Origins as well.
Origins, yeah.
Which was better than people would let, you know, have you believe, but it's the weakest of the four. Arkham Knight, I think, is the most underrated game of the last generation. Everyone got caught up on the whole Bat Tank thing. That game was amazing. It was so.
Because for me, everyone went nuts about the fact that you've made Arkham Knight the new character. For spoilers, anyone who play Arkham Knight, and it turned out to be Jason Todd. And they're going, mm-hmm. But what do you want from because maybe Jason Todd didn't go straight to being a Red Hood. Maybe he did.
I
thought it was great. And yeah, to me,
I love the stuff with the Joker as well.
Sorry,
I love the stuff with the Joker in that. I love the fact that he just kept appearing.
I thought that was refreshing because I didn't want another game. Like, because they did Arkham Origins just to bring the Joker back.
Yeah, 100%.
Because they killed Joker off in Arkham City. Mm-hmm. And then Arkham Origins, or it's the Black Mask, it's the Black Mask. And no, Black Mask is dead. It's the Joker pretending to be Black Mask.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, yeah, okay, refreshing. We got a new character now. It better not be the Joker. And instead, the Joker is weird Jiminy Cricket, just walking around with him and talking to him. Is like anti-conscience, if you were.
He just shows up. Yeah. Or as you're walking around, suddenly it's like he appears on a poster off in the distance. Like, he shouldn't be there.
I was playing that game at like 2 a.m. once, and I had all the lights off, just had Batman on. And then the Joker just appears out of nowhere the first time. Fucking hell, my controller flew. I shot myself, mate.
They had some good jump scares. Man-Bat, when Man-Bat shows up.
Yeah.
It made me jump, totally did. Yeah. But honestly, I would put Arkham Knight easily in my top five games of the last generation. That's how good I think it is. And as I said, I agree with the criticism that when it's the Bat Tank, they overdid it. 100%. But when you're actually driving the Batmobile, oh my, it's like a burnout game in the middle of a Batman game. And the bits when you jump off a building, you call in your Batmobile, you fly down into it and immediately start driving off, or even better, when you're driving it, you pop out and immediately go into combat. I was like, this is so fucking slick. This is like everything I want from a Batman game. And
I enjoyed
it. I'm not a DLC guy. I played all the DLC as well.
I enjoyed the Batmobile more because obviously it was all around Riddler challenges as well, because mainly the Riddler challenges were the Batmobile. And yeah, you got to utilize the Batmobile more. And the gameplay, Arkham Knight. Arkham Asylum was refreshing because it was new.
Then it came out of nowhere.
And they took that with Arkham Knight and they ran with it. Like, and again, Arkham City is great.
Arkham City is more the template for it. Yeah. And like, Arkham Knight feels like a different game because Arkham Knight is much more Metroidvania-esque.
Yeah.
With, like, you know, routes being unlocked as you kind of gain new abilities. Whereas, obviously, with City and then Knight, they opened it up a lot more. But yeah, great games. And I mean, I think that's the answer, isn't it? It's like, who do you want to do Batman games? Basically, the people are already fucking doing it. So, yeah, and although they are doing a Justice League versus Suicide Squad game next, aren't they?
Yeah, so Rocksteady are doing that because who's doing? Is it Warner Brothers? Then they're doing
Warner Brothers are doing the one with
Gotham Knights.
Gotham Knights, yeah. Gotham Knights. And Rocksteady are doing Suicide Squad, Kill the Justice League, or whatever the hell it's called.
Yeah,
but yeah, so I think we can all agree Rocksteady is the answer there. But the most interesting appearance of Batman in a video game has to be the Revenge of Shinobi. I'm not sure if you've seen the original boss battles from Revenge of Shinobi. On the Sega Mega Drive?
I played Revenge of Shinobi. I couldn't tell you if I got quite far into that game.
Well, Revenge of Shinobi, bizarrely, has, quote-unquote, I guess, takes on famous characters of the time, where realistically what we're talking about here is complete rip-offs. In that game, as Joe Musashi in Shinobi, you fight what is clearly Batman. In a later stage, you fight Spider-Man. Randomly shows up as well. And it's Rambo as well.
Rambo.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so blatant. It's so blatant. Like, the lawyers...
Oh, my God.
Like, you used to be able to... It.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, you used to be able to get away with that shit. It's like, the Contra cover on the NES is just... It is literally Hicks from Aliens. It's just like a complete rip-off. Oh, sorry, that's from Metal Gear. They rip off Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone for Contra. And it was just like, back then, these Japanese companies just like, yeah, they just get away with it. Nowadays, you'd be sued to high heaven. It was like, by the time these companies found out what was happening, it was like, oh, it's too late, it's on store shelves, let's just let it go. But yeah, Shinobi is the most blatant rip-off ever. So that was one of the more interesting takes of Batman. But yeah, I think that's, I mean, is that every, usually at this point then we sum up in terms of, all right, what's your rating out of 5 stars today?
I think it's a 3 for me.
Okay. I give it a 4. It's not a 5-star film. I'm giving it a 4. And would you encourage somebody who's never seen it before to go back and watch it now?
Yes, because I loved it when I first watched it, and it'd be interesting to see if somebody likes it watching it now. Because I loved it when I first watched it. I've lost a bit of nostalgia. I've lost a bit of luster for this film as I've watched it now. But I think somebody who's never seen it before, they need to see where it started.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a slightly different response so much. There are some bits which have aged. I would definitely say go and watch it because I think, again, what a lot of people take for granted is the visual motifs of Batman nowadays were established largely in this 89 movie, you know, whether it be the Batmobile, Gotham, the suits, the soundtrack, the full works kind of thing. But I think, obviously, it didn't work so well for you, but that timeless aesthetic allows it to get away with more. Like, the slightly stagey combats, the matte paintings, it all seems to work in this slightly golden age of cinema kind of vibe, where it's kind of, is it set in the 50s, is it set in the 80s, is it set in 2030? It's quite bizarre in that regard. And I think that gives it a lot more leeway than it would have if, say, you were watching it and it looked like 1989. If this was just kind of like Christopher Nolan's films are clearly set in between 2007 or 2005 and 2010. Whereas this, if it was like, you know, Chicago in 1989 and everybody looked like people did in 1989, I think it would have aged it pretty bad. But because it has that timeless aesthetic.
Because you haven't put a date stamp on it and the way it looks, like you said, it is timeless.
I think it's just the filming practices then kind of takes me out of it.
And I totally get it. Yeah. I totally get it. But like saying, for all your criticism, though, we are saying, go and watch it.
Oh, yeah,
give it
a go. Definitely go. You've got to give this film a go. Yeah, definitely.
Give it a go and then follow it up with Batman Returns, which is absolutely fucking insane.
There's me sounding like Rain Man. Definitely watch Batman.
Yeah, so before we get down, I guess usually what we do now is like ask you very politely, check us out on Facebook, check us out on Twitter, check us out on Instagram. We're on that?
Yeah, we're on Instagram at HeyYouGuys80s on all three, basically, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Hey, so that I'll leave it to you then to sign off and let us know what we will be watching and reviewing next week.
And if you could drop us a mail on HeyYouGuys80s@gmail.com.
That too.
Any suggestions or any feedback, greatly appreciated. So I've been texting you throughout the week and the day, bouncing back and forth. I'm struggling with quite a few films on the list as what to cover next.
There's hardly any films released in the 80s, so you must be struggling.
I am really struggling as what I want to cover next. Like, do I want to go batshit crazy or do I want to go...
Do you go niche or mainstream, you know?
I've got to go my favourite film, and I've already put it out there. So we're going a bit of Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Awesome. I mean, it was only a matter of time before we did
watch
Die
Hard next week.
Awesome. Well, we won't go into the details. We'll just say we're doing Die Hard next week. You know, if you want to do a bit of preparation, please watch it. I'm sure it's ingrained in your memory anyway. But yeah, this is one of the biggies, man. This is up there with, you know, Back to the Future, stuff like that. You know, this is one of the, well, top five quintessential 80s movies. So yeah, I'm looking forward to this one, man. And honestly, I hope you'll all join us. Also, we'll be doing a very brief bonus episode for Justice League Snyder Cut. I know that doesn't make any sense, but we have to talk about it. But yeah, until next week, thanks, man. It's been awesome.
Yep. Thank you very much. And we'll speak to you all next week.
That's it. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Are you good?